this neighborhood for 30 years. This is the worst that's ever happened. It was like being in a hurricane last night.
Residents in Anchorage clean up the damage from last night's windstorm. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, September 5th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Congress faces another budget-cutting deadline.
Unfortunately, it didn't force them to reach a deal this past fall, but hopefully now, with the sequester much closer to going off, it can finally force lawmakers into agreement.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Last night, Anchorage residents experienced extremely high winds, resulting in tree loss and structural damage to homes, but the distribution was erratic. Andy Dixon is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Anchorage. He says wind measurement equipment along Turnagain Arm and Glen Alps failed shortly after 6 p.m. last evening, but there were dramatic citizen accounts mixed in with the official record.
Have received unofficial reports as high as upwards of 130 miles an hour on the hillside, but I would stress that those are unofficial at this time. We are attempting to confirm those, but we have not yet. In terms of official observations, the highest we recorded was 88 miles an hour along McHugh Creek, and that was at 5:50 p.m. Similarly, 75 miles an hour near Potter Marsh.
Dixon says the highest gust in the city itself was 63 miles per hour recorded at the port shortly after 10 p.m. Dixon says there's been nearly half an inch of rain so far, but there are no flooding concerns. He says the high wind warnings were only issued for Anchorage, Turnagain Arm, and Portage Valley, but winds affected the entire Aleutian Chain and parts of southwest Alaska.
Widespread 40 to 50 mile an hour winds everywhere from the western Aleutians through the eastern Aleutians, southwest mainland, and much of south central, including Anchorage. But Anchorage, in terms of impacts and unusual winds, the winds that we experienced here last night in Anchorage were definitely the most notable and newsworthy.
Dixon says the path of the wind from the hillside down through the city was unusual. As of this evening, thousands of people in Anchorage are still without power. Anchorage Municipal Light and Power is working to restore service to their customers, but the company does not have the ability to track how many residents are affected or where the outages are. The Matanuska Electric Association says 3,000 of its customers don't have power. Chugach Electric reports about 5,000 customers are still without power in their service area, which is mostly on the hillside. All the power companies are asking customers to call and report their outage if it hasn't yet been taken care of, and they all say crews will work throughout the night to restore power. The windstorm took down trees across Anchorage and caused extensive damage to some homes and properties in the city. Alaska Public Radio Network's Annie Feit talked to homeowners surveying the wreckage.
Like many residents of Anchorage, Margie Stapleton couldn't sleep last night. As the wind blew, she says she was upstairs in her bedroom, praying and reading, alone in her house. Eventually, she got scared and went downstairs.
And I tried to sleep on the couch. I couldn't. So I got up and I looked out the window, and that's when I saw the tree swaying back and forth, and it looked like it was uprooting from the bottom, from the roots. And sure enough, 20 minutes later, it just cracked. And then this one up here broke up and fell on the other side. So there are two trees falling on top of my house. And there's a big branch that went through my garage door. So there's a big hole in there.
The two trees are nearly blocking the entrance to Stapleton's house off of Boniface in East Anchorage. Stapleton's friend and neighbor, Linda Garrett, also lost a tree in her backyard, but it didn't damage her house. Still, she says it was a frightening night.
I've lived in this neighborhood for 30 years. This is the worst that's ever happened. It was like being in a hurricane last night.
As Garrett and Stapleton talk, Stapleton's next-door neighbor, Corey Michael Erickson, walks over. She reaches out to give him a hug.
Come here. I'm going to give you a hug first.
Erickson watched the tree fall on Stapleton's house in the middle of the night. He raced over to make sure she was okay.
I pounded on your door, so just wanted to make sure. Yeah, I was terrified. I wasn't going to sleep. I still haven't slept. I mean, I'm helping everyone out around the trailer court, so.
And what kind of damage are you seeing?
I'm seeing trees on top of roofs. I'm seeing roofs ripped off. I mean, it's pretty bad, really bad.
In neighborhood after neighborhood, Anchorage residents are shaking their heads and picking up the pieces. In Unaka Valley, trees were down in nearly every yard. At 10 a.m., the main access road to the neighborhood was still blocked by several downed trees. I park on one side of the roadblock and walk up to a massive tree laying across the street. Leola Montero is on the other side.
This is the main access in, and it's completely shut off. You can see by at least 5 or 6 trees or more. And the other access over by Nunaka School was pretty much closed as well. They got that one cleared somewhere around 8 o'clock this morning. They were clearing that one. But throughout the neighborhood, many of the streets have trees down. There's several on houses, several on cars.
It's a day when anybody with a chainsaw is very much in demand. Aaron Pascar with Nunaka Valley Neighborhood Patrol has been clearing trees from roads. He started working overnight to make sure emergency vehicles and the power companies could get into the neighborhood.
Well, we got two chainsaws. There's a couple of guys beside Keith and myself, and we're wrapping chains around it after we cut them up into good-sized chunks. And then we haul them to the side of the road.
On another street in East Anchorage, Shane Gage is standing outside his house. The only tree in his front yard is laying on its side.
Well, last night, of course, the wind came up and had the windows open, and we actually watched the trees sway back and forth, and one of the sways was just a little bit too large, and it took the tree down. It's a beautiful weeping birch, and it'll be missed.
Gage actually owns a landscaping business. As he talked, his work truck was idling in front of his house. He was about to head out for what he suspected would be a very full day.
We just did one for the neighbor. A tree fell on his driveway, and of course he couldn't get his cars out, so we cut that up this morning and got that out of the way. And I'm sure we'll be doing more of that as the day progresses.
Gage says he's lived all over Alaska since 1996 and has never experienced anything like the high winds that hit his neighborhood last night. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Most of the areas surrounding Anchorage seem to have avoided serious damage from last night's windstorm. Matanuska Susitna Borough Deputy Emergency Services Director Casey Cook says the borough got some wind and rain, but not much else. Seward, Girdwood, and Whittier also fared relatively well. But the story around Chugiak was quite different. Ray Holmson, who lives in the Birchwood area near Chugiak, says he's never seen anything like the storm in the 45 years he's lived on North Birchwood Loop.
Lots of trees down. And on my acre, I have probably about 20 to 25 trees flat on the ground and another 20 to 30 leaning way over. Luckily, nothing hit our house and on any of our outbuildings, but our neighbors had trees fall on their, both neighbors on either side had trees fall on their houses.
Holmson says he lost about 50 trees on his property, all birches. About 500 homes in the Delta Junction area were still without power this afternoon, more than 18 hours after high winds gusting to 76 miles per hour pounded the area last night. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
By mid-afternoon, gusts were exceeding 60 miles per hour, kicking up towering clouds of dust off the silty banks of the Delta River, peeling roofing from buildings, hurling plywood and plastic sheeting, and generally wreaking havoc. Golden Valley Electric Association crews restored power to most of Delta a little after 2 this morning. GVEA spokeswoman Cassandra Cerny says they were still at work this afternoon at a couple of dozen trouble spots around the area.
We have 3 crews working in the Delta area, and we're guessing there are about 25 to 30 locations that they're working at.
Cerny says GVEA officials hope to restore power to all area customers by midnight. The State Division of Forestry says 2 new fires were reported around Delta Tuesday, one in a residential area sparked by a downed power line, another smoldering near Tenderfoot Hill, about 30 miles north of town. Both were extinguished. National Weather Service meteorologist John Lingus says winds picked up later Tuesday afternoon, gusting to 70 miles per hour. He says the biggest blasts hit later Tuesday evening.
That 76 miles an hour occurred for a very short period of time, between 8:30 and 9 p.m.
Lingus says motorists making their way south on the Richardson Highway will still run into winds, especially north of Isabel Pass. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor recounts the famous phone call she received from President Ronald Reagan.
I'd like to ask you to come be the next member of the Supreme Court. Is that all right with you?
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. And by the Federal Aviation Administration, setting standards for the operation of aircraft in airports. faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll free at 1-866-357-4704.
Because Cook Inlet beluga whales are listed as endangered, the Endangered Species Act mandates that critical habitat be identified and a recovery plan must be developed. Mandy Magura is a marine biologist with the National Marine Fisheries Service. Magura is a NMFS liaison to the recovery team tasked with developing the plan for Cook Inlet whales. She says the process is complex. It could take decades, and the cost will be significant. That expense may be a major factor for the plan's success, because Magura says the requirement to write the plan is where the mandate ends.
There is a drawback. Just because there is a recovery plan in place, that doesn't mean that we necessarily are going to be given the funding to implement all the actions. One of the requirements of the ESA is to develop a recovery plan. Unfortunately, there is no similar requirement that we will get funding to implement the recovery plan.
The recovery team last met in April. Another meeting is scheduled for February, and Magura says they hope to have a draft plan ready for review by next spring. Oil and gas producers in Cook Inlet are concerned that critical habitat designations and a recovery plan will add regulatory burdens and expense to their projects. Magura says specific actions haven't been identified, but they have made a list of potential threats and stressors.
But they haven't identified any specific one action as being a cause or the concern. So I really don't have the information to give you at this point in time because I haven't seen what they're proposing for recovery actions to be able to know if there is a concern for any one particular industry.
The state of Alaska sued over the EAS listing, but has not appealed a court decision upholding that listing. Doug Vincent Lang is the state's acting director of the Division of Wildlife Conservation and the Endangered Species Coordinator. He says the state also sued over the critical habitat designation, citing two concerns. First, the size.
Especially the designation of the entire west side of Cook Inlet all the way down basically to the outlet of Cook Inlet, as well as Kachemak Bay. And we didn't think that all of those areas represented critical habitat based on the primary constituent elements, which are habitat elements necessary for beluga recovery that the service itself had identified.
Vincent Lang also has concerns that more regulation and the potential for lawsuits could have a dampening effect on future oil, gas, and other development. He says NOAA conducted an economic impact study and the state did another. He says they were vastly different.
We estimated that the overall cost in tens of millions of dollars, where they estimated it on the orders of tens to hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. It's magnitudes orders of difference between our two estimates of economic impact.
But Alaska Pacific University biologist Dr. Leslie Cornick says designating critical habitat does not mean all development ceases.
That's a huge misconception. It just means that if you are going to do a project, there are a series of steps that you need to take to make sure that your intended project is not going to make the situation worse for beluga whales.
Cornick says it does add more hoops and expense for developers, but she says there has to be a balance between development and nature, and she thinks many Anchorage residents would agree.
I don't know anyone in Anchorage who isn't absolutely giddy when they get to pull over on the side of the Seward Highway and watch beluga whales. And we're looking at losing that. And, you know, I think it's more than just an aesthetic cost. It basically is, you know, another message to the ocean that we don't care.
Dr. Cornick says not caring is a choice.
If we don't care about the ocean, that's, you know, that's a choice that we can make. But then I guarantee you the ocean's going to stop taking care of us. And that will be a very bad day.
Links to the work of the Cook Inlet Beluga Recovery Team are at our website, alaskapublic.org. In tomorrow's conclusion, we'll look at potential causes of the decline. The country is staring down a fiscal crisis come January 2nd. If Congress fails to act, a combination of more than $1 trillion in federal spending cuts and the expiration of the Bush-era tax cuts will likely send the economy into recession. That duo of tax increases and spending cuts has been dubbed the fiscal cliff, an ominous name for a serious situation. APRN's Peter Granitz explains the sequester, a formal name for the impending spending cuts, in this first of a three-part series.
It goes back to last summer's debate over the debt ceiling. After months of political brinksmanship, Congress agreed to raise the debt limit, the amount of money the government can borrow to stay afloat. But deficit hawks demanded a plan to cut hundreds of billions of dollars from the federal deficit in return. And the way to do that was the Super Committee, a group of 12 lawmakers from the House and Senate who were charged with reducing the federal deficit by $1.5 trillion over a decade.
It was basically set up to fail.
Jason Piquet is research director at the Nonpartisan Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Piquet says Congress wrote the Budget Control Act, the law that created the supercommittee, with a dangling threat, the sequester. If the supercommittee could not reach an agreement, federal spending would be cut across the board by $1.2 trillion.
They acknowledged the need to come back to this, and so they set this sequester to go off some 400 days in the future. Unfortunately, it didn't force them to reach a deal this past fall, but hopefully now, with the sequester much closer to going off, it can finally force lawmakers into agreement.
Most believe the cuts will cut wide and deep. Government agencies can expect to lose between 8 and 10% of their operating budgets. The Office of Management and Budget must release a plan for what the cuts will look like. And Jason Piquet thinks the White House will up the ante, telling Congress, you created this mess, now fix it.
And it's probably going to say, we're not able to make thought-out, well-informed decisions about what programs are working and which ones are not, and cut the ones where we can. It's probably going to tell us all programs across the board, whether or not they're working or whether or not they're failing, are going to be cut by the same percentage.
And that leaves an incredible amount of uncertainty. Businesses that rely on government contracts cannot plan ahead. And states are in the gray, too. Kip Knutson runs Governor Sean Parnell's Washington office. He says state commissioners do not know how much money their agencies can expect.
They have a great deal of unease because we do obviously receive a lot of federal monies in the various state programs. And, you know, for them to run their programs effectively, it's always good for them to have an idea of what's coming down the pike.
And perhaps most important, citizens. Everyday people do not know what to expect. There are exemptions to Medicare, Social Security, and military personnel. But what does it mean for college students with subsidized student loans or military families who rely on TRICARE for medicine? While there are uncertainties, some things are nearly guaranteed. The Congressional Budget Office warns that the combination of the cuts and tax increases would send the economy back into recession, and it would hurl the unemployment rate back up over 9% by the end of 2013. The cuts may begin to corral the out-of-control debt and deficit, but Jason Piquet says it does not structurally change Social Security, the tax code, and Medicare and Medicaid, the largest drivers of the federal deficit.
At some point, investors say, okay, enough is enough. You've been spending or taxing in a way that's not balancing your budget, and we don't have confidence that you're going to repay us in the future.
And if investors lose confidence in the U.S. economy, interest rates spike, and the fiscal crisis becomes personal.
That makes it harder to take out a loan for a new car. That makes it harder to get an affordable mortgage for a new house. Combined, that really slows down the economy.
And there's a tough irony in that because the deficit increased in part because of the last recession. The government had to spend more on things like unemployment insurance and food stamps. There's an expectation in Washington that Congress will do exactly what it did last year, push the problem further down the line. Senator Lisa Murkowski says Congress could change the effective date of the cuts.
We punt, if you will, and come to an agreement that sequestration doesn't go away, but it's just pushed back an additional 6 months or perhaps an additional year. In other words, the hammer is still there, but we've pulled back a little bit on when that hammer comes down.
There is consensus that action sooner rather than later is better. It's safer to make the cuts on our own terms instead of the demands of creditors. But signs point to Congress holding off, especially with the election just 2 months away. And because of that, over the next 2 days, we'll look at how the sequester could potentially affect military spending in Alaska and the state's oil and gas industry. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
How do you get men to wear a life jacket when the fact is that 90% of those who die in boating accidents in Alaska are men? Well, most men won't listen to this message, but they might listen to you. So have them pledge to wear a life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. That's pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back home. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Because of last night's windstorm in Anchorage, hundreds of middle and high school students in the city missed the opportunity to hear Justice Sandra Day O'Connor speak today. The retired Supreme Court Justice is in town to talk about her life and promote a civics education program she established. iCivics offers games that teach students how the court system and other branches of government work. When the storm closed schools for the day, the court system threw together a substitute event at the Alaska Supreme Court Chambers in downtown Anchorage. O'Connor was interviewed by Dana Fabe, Chief Justice of the Alaska Supreme Court. Justice O'Connor was the first woman appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court in 1981. But she says fresh out of Stanford Law School in the 1950s, no one would hire her because of her gender.
It was interesting because I was third in my class in law school. I had done well. I'd been on the Law Review and all those things, published articles. You'd think I would have had a job offer. I didn't. And there were at least 40 law firms listed on the bulletin board at the law school at Stanford saying, Stanford law graduates, call us. We'd like to talk to you about employment. I called every single one of them. Not one of them would give me an interview.
Justice O'Connor finally took a job as an attorney in California, working for free. But eventually she did get paid for her work. She moved to Arizona and served as an assistant attorney general and state senator there before being appointed to the Arizona Court of Appeals in 1979. 2 years later, she flew to the White House for an interview with President Ronald Reagan, who was looking for someone to fill an opening on the Supreme Court. O'Connor says she enjoyed her visit with the president, but told her husband she would never get the appointment.
2 or 3 days later, I got a phone call in my chambers in Arizona, the Court of Appeals, and the voice said, it's Ronald Reagan here. How are you today? I'm fine, sir. How are you? And he said, I'd like to ask you to come be the next member of the Supreme Court. Is that all right with you? Pretty scary. So that's how it all took place.
Justice O'Connor says it was intimidating being the first woman appointed to the Supreme Court. She says the honor came with intense media scrutiny that was difficult to bear. But she says her appointment opened doors for women in the United States and all over the world. This time, it's the story of the buoy that didn't get away. The U.S. Coast Guard cutter Maple retrieved the Cape Edgecombe weather buoy last week after the errant instrument spent 6 days adrift in the Gulf of Alaska. The buoy was only about 10 miles off station, dutifully transmitting weather and ocean conditions as it slowly cruised north and west in the balmiest seas of the summer. Last time the Cape Edgecombe buoy broke loose in winter, it drifted 400 miles before anyone caught it. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Lieutenant Ray Reichel is the executive officer of the Sitka-based cutter Maple. As these things go, picking up the buoy was a breeze, if that.
When we were able to get up on scene, seas were less than 1 foot. We didn't have any registered winds at the time.
and we're able to safely get up alongside of it and bring it aboard without damaging any of the sensors.
The Cape Edgecombe buoy is 6 meters long, or around 18 feet. It's really more like a small boat than a traditional navigational can or nun. And like Reichel says, it's fairly bristling with equipment. The Maple brought the buoy back to Sitka. Resetting it where it broke off was impossible at the time. Reichel says it requires about a mile and a half of specialized mooring gear and a 6-ton concrete anchor.
The sinker itself is still there with part of the mooring, so we'll need to bring out a whole new mooring system and reset that one. But I believe it'll probably be around a 12,000-pound sinker that they'll use for that one again.
Just as the Cape Edgecombe buoy is too expensive and sophisticated an instrument to let it go wandering, it's also too important to mariners and weather forecasters to let it sit on the dock for long. Lieutenant Reichel says the NDBC is shipping up a new mooring and equipment to allow the Maple to attempt to reset the 84 buoy and to repair another buoy, 85, or the Central Gulf buoy, this October. Conditions offshore in October are typically a lot different than in August. If they get an opening, Reichel thinks the crew of the Maple can do the job.
Weather conditions are typically best at 6 foot or less to be able to safely get that over, because again, we don't want to damage any of the sensors in the process of setting up the moorings. So it'll be one that will definitely be having a lot less safe weather windows to do it, but there'll still be some available in that time frame of the year.
In the meantime, the Cape Edgecombe buoy continues to perform perfectly. Reichel says its battery of instruments is functioning, relaying weather and sea height from its very solid perch on the Coast Guard pier. The National Data Buoy Center has stopped updating the buoy's public website, however, to prevent someone from mistaking conditions on dry land in a sheltered harbor for autumn 45 miles offshore in the Gulf of Alaska. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton and Ellen Locke here in Anchorage, Tim Ellis in Delta, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Ensuring our youth understand the need for workplace safety will help prevent injuries. If your middle or high school is interested in having a youth representative speak to your students about workplace safety, call Alaska Occupational Safety and Health Youth Safety at 1-800-656-4972. This message is sponsored by Alaska Labor Standards and Safety. The Kinnick Arm Bridge will create 1,500 jobs during the 4 years of construction and spur thousands more after completion by creating access to affordable land for commercial, industrial, and residential use. For facts on the Kinnick Arm Bridge, visit kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.